Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another episode of The Daily French Show. I'm your host, Nicholas Lorimer, and today I'm joined by Ricardo Teixeira. So today we're going to be taking a step back to talk about a question of, you know, what should South Africa be focusing on when it comes to our national defense? Over recent years, we've seen that the ANC government has really degraded the funding level of the South African Defence Force, National Defence Force, over and over again, in order to support other initiatives. And, you know, to be honest, who can blame them, right? The country has faced increasing financial constraints due to the fact that the growth has been so slow and so low. And it's very hard when we have no major geopolitical threats around us to justify why we should be spending significant amounts of money on our military. So we've seen the SANDF fall into a state of kind of general disrepair, while that money has been sent off to fund everything else from the public wage bill to procurement to welfare to all these other things. And, you know, I think the ANC has been doing that in part because it's an easy political case to make. But Ricardo's recently written a piece for the Daily Friend called Why South Africa Still Needs Naval Diplomacy. And Ricardo, you're a big advocate of the South African National Defence Force. I think I've joked on some of the episodes, I don't know if you were here for them, that if you were in charge, you would give the whole budget to the military. And I am only making fun of you there, because I'm sure that's not true.
I wouldn't give it all. I would just give more than the police budget.
But considering, you know, the fact that we don't have major geopolitical enemies, why should South Africa be funding, in particular, its navy, right? Okay, army, maybe, you know, stuff along the border, domestic stuff. But why should the navy in particular be funded? And in general, why should we have more funding for our military? What's your view on that?
Man, I don't even know where to start on this one. So, firstly, where does most of our trade come from? It comes via the ocean. We're a maritime country. We've got oceans on three sides. In fact, we have three oceans. Most people will say we have two oceans, but they forget that there's the Antarctic Ocean. So South Africa's naval responsibility in terms of disaster response and constabulary roles and just sort of legal responsibility under the United Nations Convention on the Laws of the Sea, UNCLOS. South Africa is responsible for the Atlantic, the Antarctic, and the South Indian Oceans. Outside of IEEZ, all the way down to the Antarctica. So we on the Southern Atlantic have to meet Brazil, Uruguay, and Argentina halfway. And on the Indian Ocean, we need to meet Australia halfway, all the way down to the Antarctic.
So just a reminder about how this fits into sort of maritime laws and things. South Africa does have some islands.
Yes. In the Marion Islands, Prince Edward and Marion Island.
Which kind of extend South Africa's sort of naval bubble much further than you would expect, just looking at a map.
Yeah, we have an exclusive economic zone of 1.5 million square kilometers. Now, out of all of this space, we don't really see it as much of a strategic necessity, but the majority of our trade comes through the streets. The majority of our imports come through the streets. And now this route is, it used to be the fifth busiest shipping route in the world. But due to Hormuz and the Suez Canal and the Red Sea having been dipped in recent times due to just everything that's going on, the Cape Sea route, which is so the top five busiest routes, the Cape is the only one that isn't a strait. The Straits of Malacca is the other one, and then the Panama Canal. So aside from all of those, the Cape Sea route is now roughly the third busiest sea route, and it's the only one that can't be blockaded. But that doesn't mean it's not impossible at some points. If you look at the live, and I wish I could pull it up right now, but if you look at the live traffic of marine traffic around our coast, you'll note that most of the traffic happens within 100 nautical miles of our coast, where our exclusive economic zone extends out to 200 nautical miles. So most of the ships are coming through our EEZ, and that is because the further south you go, the rougher the ocean gets. And that is why our ships... when we originally got the frigates, most people will remember the argument that they were corvettes. That was a political argument because we shouldn't actually be operating corvettes because we needed vessels that were at minimum 120 meters in length in order to sail further south. the rougher the seas.
So how big is a corvette?
A corvette's typically around 100 meters. 100 meters, and it's under 3,000 tons, whereas our ships are about 3,600 tons and 120 meters. That's so crazy. They were like, that whole argument was to downplay cost and a sense of aggression. But the sort of ships that we need are frigates. But also considering the size of our area of responsibility. So if a ship is in distress, a plane goes down, there's just any sort of problem in this region, it is our legal responsibility to respond to that. So the Navy, everybody will always think of, you know, when they think of the Defense Force, they think of the Army, but the Navy is the only one that has international legal obligations. It has a constabulary role. It also has a diplomatic role in that if you want to visit another country and send a diplomatic message, you send a ship. There's a reason why gunboat diplomacy exists. We've seen how very good the U.S. has been at it in recent years, particularly the last 2 weeks. You've seen what gunboat diplomacy buys you. But it goes back to in the 1860s, 1870s, around then, when the Americans were trying to force the Japanese out of their period of isolation into trade. Because of their naval advantage, they literally just sailed their ships into the harbor and said, we're here now. And naval vessels, in a way, are the only deployable territory a country has. It is the value in it is unquantifiable, but the ability to, at any point, send a ship to another country, to send some presence, to send a level of deterrence, to send an actual piece of your territory and representatives that have a legal role in international waters. And it's just overall the size of it. It's literally something that carries your flag. The value of it is incalculable. So I'm very proud of the South African Navy and what they've been able to achieve in sailing towards India for the International Fleet Review and Exercise Milan, where they partook in the sea phase and the live fire exercises. Considering the fact that the Navy gets around 9% of the total defense budget, which itself is only 0.7% of GDP, they still managed to sail in a single trip without stopping a frigate across the Indian Ocean and show up. And it's not an easy thing to do. It's not something we can do on the regular. It's not something we've done in the last decade, but they managed to do it. And now they are on their way to visit China to extend the diplomatic visit. China has come to us twice with Exercise Mosi 2 and 3 in the last 3 years. And so they're visiting there. They've visited Singapore as well already. And then on their way back, they're stopping in Malaysia and then Kenya, Tanzania, and they'll be back in South Africa in May. So while the president can do all these state visits, they're relatively short, but the presence of a country's ship coming into your waters and announcing itself, it flexes a level of deterrence and of presence that you can't do any other way. It's not necessarily aggressive. In times of disaster, it can be something positive. I mean, the ability to deploy for example, Drakensberg, which is a support vessel which can operate as a floating hospital. It can do desalination. Its turbines on board can generate power. And it can bring a whole lot of aid and dried stores on board. Something like that is, again, it's incalculable. For disaster response in our area, if we had the ability to send a hospital ship or even just any sort of ship that can do humanitarian assistance, the value in that goes so far. So even though we may not have threats on land, we still have responsibilities and we still have opportunities. And the thing about a defense force in particular is it's not something you buy in a day. You can't reach into the cupboard and pull it out of a drawer if you haven't paid for it for the last 10 years. So we may not need it now, but if the day comes that we do need it, we don't want to think, oh, I should have spent the money.
And that's more true of navies, I think, than any other branch of a military. Ships take a very long time to build and they're very expensive. So you have to, as you say, plan way ahead and make sure that you're never caught in a position where suddenly you go, oops, we need three more frigates and we don't have them and it's going to be 6 years until we can get them. because then you might as well not have them at all.
Yeah. So the current PLAN, the Chinese Navy, or the People's Liberation Army Navy, is from its current iteration, the planning kind of began at the Taiwan Strait crisis in the late 90s, this was 1998. Also, at that time, we sailed a ship to Taiwan, strangely. But at that time, the Americans sailed a carrier strike group through the Taiwan Strait. It kind of woke the Chinese up, and they decided that this was never going to happen again. And it took them about a decade of planning to get to the point where they could start building. And now 70% of their fleet, which is the largest fleet in the number of ships, in terms of tonnage, it's still about 70% the size of the U.S. Navy. But in terms of number of ships, they exceed them. But that Navy, 70% of it was built in the last 15 years. Yeah, and they are still not combat tested. They still are still practicing and gaining the skills and experience and the knowledge necessary to do these complex tasks. But it shows that, you know, with about 12 years of planning and then 15 years of building, it's not something you can do in a year. It's not something you can do in 5 years. It's not something you can do in one presidential term. It takes a level, or even two presidential terms, it takes a level of long-term planning that requires a lot of effort, a lot of funding, and a serious level of competency that I think we don't currently possess within the South African government.
So someone might argue against this and saying, well, you know, that's all nice to have and all that. But ultimately, you know, if we ever get involved in some sort of naval conflict, there's no way that South Africa can compete. If we're going to be challenged by any kind of real naval power that can project power over the seas, like the United States, like China, like India, you know, we can never build anywhere close to enough ships. So what's the point? Because they're all just going to be destroyed in the first 5 hours anyway. So why should we bother? What's your response to that?
Well, therein is they're not going to get destroyed in the first 5 hours if you have a plan. If you see it coming, you have early warning and you have ways to prepare, it's not going to happen. You know, you fail to prepare, you prepare to fail. Secondly, there is what Singapore's strategy originally was when they were building up their military, which is they went through three phases. It was hedgehog, shrimp, dolphin, or porcupine. And that's the sort of strategy we need to adopt, where the principle of the strategy is, I don't need to win. I just need to make winning as costly for you as possible in order to deter you from taking that decision, because you just think the risk is not worth the reward. So that is the sort of strategy we need to adopt right now. The shrimp strategy was to have a quick reaction, hard-hitting punch, and a quick maneuver. And specifically there, they were talking about the bullet shrimp that has the fastest punch and one of the hardest punches in terms of body size to the actual impact of the punch. That was it. And then Singapore then went on to the dolphin strategy, which is that you can stand toe-to-toe with other animals of your size. Which you consider that for Singapore, that meant being able to deter China. And you look at the size of Singapore versus China, and then you compare the military capabilities, you can see how it took them 60 years to get to that point. But for us right now, it's more of I'm a very big fan and a big proponent of irregular warfare, whereby a friend of mine who's a researcher and a naval officer said to me, irregular warfare means you take expensive things and you use them incorrectly. But that's essentially is what you do, is where you take conventional tools and where you accept you don't have the numerical superiority, so you use them unconventionally. You use them in ways where you leverage their effects over the numbers. So in South Africa's case, it means having a larger submarine fleet than we do a frigate fleet, because you want to be able to hide. You want to have some sort of standoff range where, no, it's very difficult to track you, but the idea of, we go there, they got six submarines at sea, and that's six submarines we got to find. And then they still have four more in port. It's a lot more of a deterrent than, oh, they've got four frigates. You can pick up a frigate from a long way. You just need a maritime patrol aircraft. As soon as they can pick it up from the air, which from an airborne radar, it is quite far away. But a submarine has a lot higher of a deterrent value, in my opinion. But it does mean we still also need more frigates, because we need presence and we need things that can fling missiles pretty far, and that's where the frigates come in. We also need more fighter aircraft, and that's why the Gripen was particularly chosen, was because we need fighter aircraft that we can disperse to many locations quickly and can operate with the smallest possible footprint. And that's exactly what the Gripen was designed around. We need a big logistical capacity, and we need a surge capacity. What we don't necessarily need is 40 motorized infantry battalions that only know how to fight from the vehicle. That is not what we need right now. South African National Defence Force needs to be restructured and repurposed. And whereas the Navy is currently the third funded force, I think they should be the first funded force.
So I think the thing this all comes back to the end of the day, because, you know, you can look at all these things you suggest we need and all the arguments, and then someone who is a proponent of, you know, mainly focusing on the government focusing on crime could probably come up with a whole bunch of good reasons to fund the police with that money. Someone who talks about the damage caused to our society by our poor health could talk about a similar thing for our health system, et cetera, et cetera. And for me, the bottom line is that one of the problems South Africa has, yes, there's a lot of things that probably do need more money in this country when our government spends it. But the biggest problem is actually we spend money so badly.
Yeah, that is a big problem. We don't get a bang for our buck. Right. Our purchasing power parity is abysmal.
Exactly. And part of that is because, you know, we have these procurement laws which do not prioritize value for money. They prioritize other objectives, localization. They prioritize race or gender. They prioritize all sorts of other things. But then you also have issues like corruption. You have issues like just the general inefficiency of the state. And so the bottom line here is that we need to fix the efficiency of the state, I think, in so many ways before we can actually really begin looking at any major spending initiatives. On top of that, you're also always going to have this sort of bitter knife fight over every single budget if your economy isn't growing. Because if your economy isn't growing, your budget isn't growing. So economic growth and government efficiency are two of the most important things that South Africa needs to solve. And then, you know, in a future where we're growing at 5% per year, we can say, yeah, sure, we can double the military's budget. Yeah. That's not going to be an enormous cost to the rest of society. And we can do all of these things that you're talking about. We can have force projection. Yeah. We can become a real middle power, which is what South Africa could potentially be.
And therein, the secret lies in dealing with the same problem that has caused our military to end up where it is, for our economy to end up where it is, and for our overspending to end up where it is. And it's ultimately all just a result of ANC policy.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. All right, let's move on to our next story, transitioning from soldiers going overseas and defending the nation to soldiers carrying out police activities.
Gross misuse.
Yes. On Thursday this morning, there were raids by South African National Defence Force soldiers on some Zama-Zama, that is illegal mining activities in Randfontein. There's also been deployment of South African National Defence Force forces, which Michael and I discussed briefly yesterday, to many communities that have been really badly ravaged by gang violence. The South African National Defence Force soldiers in Randfontein moved in a convoy of marked vehicles. They moved towards a group of Zama-Zamas who'd been working in an open field. The Zama-Zamas fled when they saw the army vehicles approaching, some of them disappearing into underground holes, others scattering and vanishing into the nearby veld. The soldiers, accompanied by policemen, confiscated some of the mining machinery and burnt some material used by the Zama-Zamas. This veld is about 3 kilometers from the Soprong informal settlement, which recently, due to the violence being caused by the Zama-Zamas, had essentially 300 people flee to a neighboring area to escape the violence and extortion. And Ricardo, you know, when I see operations like this, when I see the army doing stuff, I mean, firstly, there's the bigger question of, you know, are soldiers police? The answer is, as I'm sure you could explain, no. But also, this is exactly the sort of showy, flash-in-the-pan kind of operation that doesn't fix structural issues.
Yeah.
It's probably helpful to show some force and burn some equipment, But ultimately, unless people are caught, unless people are prosecuted, unless there's intelligence, unless there's breaking up of the financial infrastructure around these operations, these criminal groups, you're not going to do anything. Like, these guys are going to be back. And, you know, some of them are going to have to take a hit to their profits very temporarily to replace what's been destroyed. But there's just too much money to be made, and it's too easy to make it. What's your take on the story?
Well, my first take on this is, firstly, bad operational planning. To just drive in marked vehicles in broad daylight, no wonder they're scattered. It doesn't seem like they arrested many people. If they wanted to be serious about it, you come in at night and you infiltrate quietly and you use deception and you take your troops and you infiltrate them quietly in a box shape, and then you spring in and you close the box when everybody starts waking up, or you get them while they're still asleep. What they've done here seems more like political theater, where it was a big showy, we've arrived, big mass vehicles, burn some stuff, yeah, we're doing our bit. And that's part of the problem, is that they don't actually know what they're supposed to be doing, because soldiers are not police. I am a very, very big, I'm strongly against this use of soldiers domestically. I am a big opponent of it. And I've been talking quite loudly about it, but ultimately here, what we have is just an acceptance of the failure of our police force in that. And also, again, the failure of government policy in not knowing what the defense force is supposed to do. So every time the police force fails at their job, you just send in the military. And that's not how we should be doing things. We have a history in South Africa about the use of the military in poor areas and domestically. And it is a very painful history. It is one that we should not be trying to repeat. And then because of its lessons, the Defense Act and the Police Act were specifically written in a way to outline a separation of mandate, that the police are only allowed to use the military for assistance during national emergencies. But what you see the police doing here, what you saw them doing in Joburg yesterday, is not military work. That is police work. And if you've got soldiers operating as police, you are blurring the lines, and there's a problem that the military thinks it needs to be doing counterterrorism when that is a police function. But if you keep blurring the lines and the mandates keep rubbing up against each other in 3 years' time, where we currently don't have a clear differentiation on responsibility and roles and authority here, but if we go on down this path, within 3 years' time, there's going to be no distinction between our military and our police.
Yeah, no, that's not a state of affairs that we should be in at all. Yeah. And I think it just comports with something that you've mentioned one of the previous times I had you on the podcast. I think we just have this very old-fashioned approach in so many ways to policing and to law enforcement, which is not really to, like, you know, follow through, make sure things are properly done, all the paperwork is done, the cases actually end up with people going to prison, all these sort of things. It's more just like the police arrive and they beat up people and they chase people and they shoot people, and then everyone goes, and you know, adding the army into that's not really going to make that problem any better.
Our police are a hammer and all they see is nails.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, unfortunately, crime intelligence has been so completely taken over by criminal gangs, it seems, that's the part of the police that should be actually doing stuff like this. They should be saying, well, who is the person making the money from this? Who is the transit point that's selling these materials? Who's breaking the law? Where? Who's not declaring their taxes? All those aspects are what should be being investigated. And that's just, you know, instead, we'll just burn some stuff, whatever, and then we go out. And that's not really solving problems.
There just seems to be such a profound lack of a plan. The biggest thing I'm worried about here in this deployment is the mission creep, because the authority and the authorization has not been clarified. The communication and the differentiation in mandates about, like, where does the military's mandate stop? Where does the police one start? Who is in charge? Who's helping who? That is already so murky that I can guarantee that the idea of an end state or an end goal does not exist. And that is the biggest problem, because if we don't already have a clearly defined end state, like, this is what mission success is, this is what the end is, that goalpost is just going to keep moving. And eventually we're going to round up with a 3 to 5 year long deployment. And they will eventually, the military will just kind of become a police force. Because if you don't know what the end looks like, you'll never find it.
Yeah.
And exactly. The goalposts are just going to keep shifting. You're going to say, well, it's get this mine closed. And then when that one's done, it's like, oh, well, you know, there's
a stop this line here.
It's a drug problem in that neighborhood. Then you go there and it's like, oh, well, you know, maybe it's that neighborhood. And it's just going to keep going.
Actually, to be honest, in Westbury yesterday, we kind of saw that a bit when there were raids by police and SNDF. And, you know, without warrants and things, they just barged into people's houses and tore them up apart looking for drugs. And it's
footage, I shared it on X, and I actually said, like, I don't even know where to start here. It's the footage of an MP, a military policeman, just going, like, ruffling through someone's hedge. Like, I don't know what he was looking for or what he thought he was going to find. But it's just a well-trimmed hedge, and he's like ruffling through it, and he's like, "I'm sure no one's hiding drugs in there, my guy. It looks like a well-maintained hedge. I really don't know what you're doing." And then footage of people being dragged out of their homes, and the soldier coming out with like a little jar of weed. Like, I'm sorry, did we not just have a high court and a constitutional court ruling that people had the right to privacy to use cannabis in their own homes? What are you doing? Oh, this guy's a criminal. He's got 2 grams of weed. Like, leave the guy alone. Yeah,
and the people running brothels and selling niopa and tick and all that, you know, this is not how they operate. They're well gone by the time they see this clunking, slow force charging down the street. But anyway, speaking of lack of a good plan, let's move on to our last story. And this is a slightly weird one. There's currently a fight within senior levels of the ANC, according to a report from News 24, with some ANC members pushing for a traditional cleansing ritual at Lathuli House, believing that the reason the ANC is in the trouble it's in is because there has been a spiritual attack perpetrated by dark forces emanating from Jacob Zuma. Some people within the ANC believe that the reason that they had a difficult time in 2024 was not due to the fact that unemployment is in the 40s, was not due to the fact that the economy is barely growing, is not due to the rampant crime, corruption, all these other things. It was, in fact, possibly due to nefarious, unseen forces carried out at the behest of Jacob Zuma. So these leaders in the ANC have proposed a ritual to do a spiritual cleansing of the party headquarters. However, there are others inside the ANC who are rather opposed to this. They say that, speaking anonymously to the media, that, quote, it would make a mockery of the ANC. Apparently, one of the main leaders pushing for this cleansing ceremony from the ANC is Baleka Mbete. And she's quoted, an anonymous source quoted in the media says she's really pushing for this cleansing. She was approached by people urging the need for ritual cleansing, and she firmly believes it is necessary. We said, no, you can't do that. You'll embarrass us. We know exactly what it is that makes people lose confidence in us. It's because of those wrongdoers. Baleka Mbete has argued that the party must observe its traditions. Now, look, you know, spiritual cleansing probably can't hurt. Has Jacob Zuma engaged in nefarious magics to undermine his opponents in the country? Probably has. I get the feeling, though, that this is once again another example of senior people in the ANC just either being unable to recognize why the party is in the difficult situation that it's in currently, or alternatively looking desperately for a scapegoat to blame the party's failures on. It can't be because of anything we've done. No, there must be unseen forces at work. Ricardo, like, if you wanted to understand why the ANC just seems to be spinning its tires in the mud, considering as its fortunes, struggle, this story should be a prime example. What's your take on this?
Man, I must preface this by saying I grew up in a very Catholic household, the sort of Catholic household where we had bottles of holy water, blessed salt, and sticks of sage and would do these sorts of things. And I am now no longer a practicing Catholic. I will go as far as to say that I am a borderline militant atheist. So it's very difficult for me to talk about these things because my experiences in it have just been that they typically only become a consideration when you're in a point where, like, well, clearly nothing else is working. I'm not doing anything different. And it's a level of stubbornness of you don't want to change your ways. And you just assume that if you do this little thing, it'll make you feel better. Therefore, it makes the problem go away. And it is very much a, in my opinion, it's the result of a stubbornness and a refusal to accept reality. And I agree that it would make a mockery of the ANC, but unfortunately, the ANC has already made a mockery of itself.
Yeah, look, you know, I look at the story and you sort of think, and it's interesting that there is this fight inside the ANC, and I think part of that is reflecting this. You know, the ANC has gone through this interesting transformation where in 94 it was a much more sort of urban-focused organization, right? Its strength really was
really academic, well thought out, with a strong philosophy.
And more than that, when you go back even to its founding days, right, a lot of the founding generation, the ANC, are these people who were sort of educated in mission schools and that sort of thing. And they had this kind of quite sort of Western orientation, to use a term that I think is not always super useful. But in this case, you know, I think you understand what I mean. And yet, the sort of the rise of Jacob Zuma, and the fact that the ANC has changed from being this urban-focused party in the 90s after it took power, there was even fears in the ANC that the traditional leaders would be this incredible threat to its power. And I think that's one of the reasons why the ANC has bent over backwards in so many cases to sort of appease traditional leaders and to kind of bring them on board and that they were included in the constitution, all these sort of things. But as the ANC has lost ground and enthusiasm and gravity in South Africa's urban areas, it's increasingly focused on its rural constituencies. And now that's the backbone of the party's voting base. And traditional leaders are a very important constituency to the ANC. And that includes traditional beliefs, very religious communities, all these sort of things. And I think this is actually, this clash in the ANC is a clash between those two factions. You've got the sort of probably more old-fashioned part of the ANC, which is more urban-focused, and the one that is more sort of traditional rural-focused. And these two, you know, quite frankly, don't really always have that much in common with each other, apart from a sort of vague allegiance to socialism of some kind. But, you know, as it's kind of like the difference between the EFF and the ANC and MK, right? MK represents that sort of more rural traditionalist viewpoint on South African politics, and the EFF sort of starts from some of the same premises about the country, but it's more representative of that urban force within the ANC. And the fact that those two parties have split off and essentially do have these differences between them, I think, is interesting. And it shows also, I think, that the ANC is still got some major differences inside the party that are not being bridged. You know, when you start to run into trouble, everyone starts to turn on each other and get angry over every small thing. And it's like, oh, well, we're only in this mess because you guys did this, or you guys did this, or we haven't done this. And it's usually a kind of a death spiral that an organization can't really easily recover from. And to me, when I see this story, this is what
it's the death spiral.
Yeah, it's the death spiral. It's reaching for any thing to blame that doesn't involve sort of introspection of how what the party is done right or what it's done wrong.
How many of the people in the ANC genuinely still can't accept that they're losing support and that it's because of their behavior? It's the consequences of their actions. I wish that people would come forward and be like, yeah, I think we need to do this because it's going to fix things, just so you can see who they are and understand that they're the problem.
Yes, yes. As Fikile Mbalula said after the 2024 election, We can't strut about like peacocks acting like we won when we didn't. But yeah. Anyway, that is all the time we have for today. We hope you found this show interesting. We will see you all tomorrow. Oh, my goodness, it's Friday already. At 1:30 for the live show tomorrow if you're watching on YouTube. Otherwise, you shall hear us tomorrow afternoon. Cheers, everyone, and have a great day.
The Daily Friend Show and The Daily Friend are a project of the Institute of Race Relations, the IRR. The IRR is a think tank which was founded in 1929 to study race relations in South Africa and works to change government policy to improve race relations through non-racialism and to ensure the prosperity of all South Africans. If you like our work and would like to support us, please go to irr.org.za and click Support the IRR. Or you can go to thedailyfriend.co.za and click the Fund Us button.